whatever your challenge is, if it's doing a Seven Summits or doing an Everest or just going for a long ride or whatever it might be, I think having those kind of goals and challenges that you can do and that you can do safely during this time was like the most important thing to me.
Welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. I'm Matthew Piorro. You just heard from Ryan Atkins. He was talking about his Seven Summits challenge that he undertook in February. For 7 days, Atkins climbed, virtually that is, the highest peaks on each of the world's continents. The place where he actually gained all that elevation was in and around his home in Sutton, Quebec, a little more than 100 kilometers east of Montreal. The way he climbed was on a fat bike one day, on a virtual riding platform another, and on a gravel bike as well. He also ran and skied his way to the high elevations he needed to reach. You might remember hearing Atkins on this podcast more than a year ago. He and two other riders took on the Wabusk Trail, the world's longest winter road that runs from northern Ontario to Manitoba. He's also been part of bike-based expeditions along James Bay and in northern Quebec. About 10 years ago, Atkins raced mountain bikes in Canada Cups and a few World Cups, such as Bromont and Mont-Saint-Anne. He was a world unicycle trials champion twice in 2006 and 2008. More recently, he's been focused on obstacle course racing. He's been the world's toughest mudder 6 times, Spartan Ultra World Champion twice, and he's won the OCR World Championships. Needless to say, he likes to push and challenge himself. When I first heard of Atkins' Seven Summits Challenge, I thought, well, that's just bonkers. Especially the day he gained 6,961 meters on a treadmill. That's the height of Aconcagua. I wanted to know what attracted Atkins to this challenge with its jaw-dropping difficulty, both physically and mentally. Atkins seems to have a superhuman enthusiasm for daunting and repetitive tasks. Still, he found very cool moments throughout the challenge. They were more than just silver linings, but insights I think he would have never gotten otherwise. Also, he ate a lot of cookies and gummy bears. So have a listen. And if you think you might want to try climbing Seven Summits yourself, you'll hear some tips that will help you with your own bonkers challenge. Ryan Atkins, in February, you found a way to climb the highest summits of the world's 7 continents. You did that in 7 days. You also did that without worrying about airlines or travel restrictions. Tell us how you climbed those summits.
Absolutely. So I climbed those summits, I guess, virtually by running, skiing, fat biking. I did one day on the treadmill, another day of skiing, a day on Zwift, and a day on the gravel bike.
And why did you do this?
Basically, I just had gotten to my wit's end in terms of, you know, being rejected with, you know, travel issues. There was a race I really was supposed to do down in the US at the end of February, and I had to say no to it because of, again, quarantine restrictions coming back into Canada, and it was just going to be too expensive and too complicated and all that. And I think that, you know, it had totaled probably 14 or 15 times where this has happened to me, where I've, you know, gotten excited for an event and then kind of been shut down by the global situation. And honestly, it was just very frustrating. So I said, I'm going to do something that's going to be hard. It's going to be cool. It's going to be challenging. And there's no way that someone can stop me. There's no way that, you know, I'm going to get some government official who says, you can't ride up this hill all day. So I was just kind of took matters into my own hands. And it was actually really empowering to do something where I could kind of control everything and, you know, make it happen instead of just have another hopeful event get canceled.
And what inspired like the Seven Summits format? Where did you get this idea from?
I guess it all kind of stems from the concept of Everesting. Back in the summer, I set the record for Everesting on foot running up and running down the hill. I think it was 11 hours or so. And like, I just love the concept. It's like, it's really cool. It's really kind of cut and dry. It's pretty tough. And I thought, well, what if I wanted it to be harder than Everesting? And so then the idea was like, I could Everest 7 times in a week and do it all different activities. And then as I kind of started crunching the numbers and thinking about it, you know, doing it in February and doing it in cold temperatures and all that stuff, I kind of came to the conclusion that that might be biting off a little bit more than I could chew. I mean, maybe still I'll try that one day. But then I was like, okay, well, what's a little bit easier than Everesting 7 days in a row? And I kind of came up with this 7 summits concept, which 7 days in a week, 7 summits. It all just kind of fits so well. And it was still a lot of vertical gain over the week, but it was kind of like, at least I'll be able to have normal sleeps at night and I won't be, you know, because I think if I had tried to Everest 7 days in a row, I'd probably be like on foot. Everesting at a casual pace would probably take around 14 or 15 hours. So that would leave me with not much time by the time I make my food and have a sleep and things like that. So I figured that was just too much. So 7 summits is what I settled on, and it worked out awesome.
You are generally always at a high level of fitness. Whenever I've spoken to people you've ridden with on some of your expedition rides, and these are very fit people, they always mention you with a bit of awe, especially how you can just set a fast pace for long periods of time. Since you are a trained athlete, did you just get off the metaphorical couch and begin this 7 Summits challenge, or was there some sort of preparation?
I would say pretty close to getting off the metaphorical couch, because up until about a week before I did it, I thought I was going to be racing in Florida, and then I wasn't. But kind of all season, I've been doing a bunch of biking, a bunch of skiing, a little less running because, you know, it's winter and who wants to run in the snow when you can ski? But I think my training had kind of been, unbeknownst to me, like pretty good for it. So I just thought I would be able to handle it, and I went for it.
You operate very well in a variety of disciplines. As you mentioned, there's running, cycling, skiing, there's even climbing. Tell me about the importance of mixing up disciplines.
It's kind of been how I've been training for the last several years. And it was actually really evident during this challenge, because it was kind of like as soon as I did one activity for, you know, 8 or 10 hours and something would start getting a little bit sore, the next day I'd be doing something fairly different. So for instance, the first day I ran and I was using poles. Then the next day I skied and also using poles. And by the end of my second day of doing this, I had been, you know, using the poling action with the straps on your wrists, starting to actually really hurt my wrists and my arms. And so then the next day I was actually on the treadmill, not using my hands at all. So it was like a perfect kind of like rest for that muscle. And then after the treadmill day, my Achilles started kind of hurting because I was running at, you know, around 30% all day long. And I think I was slowly on the path to Achilles tendonitis. And, you know, luckily for me, the next day I was fat biking up and down a hill. So then my Achilles was like totally rested doing that activity. So it was really cool seeing how like doing these repetitive activities for hours on end, but then switching to a different repetitive activity would kind of not only affect, you know, me physically, but also affect like all the little ligaments and tendons and muscles, and like allow me to kind of keep going. I think if I had done this just doing one activity the whole time, it would have been quite a bit tougher on all those little muscles.
Your first activity or your first summit was Puncak Jaya in Indonesia, virtually. It's also known as Karsten's Pyramid. That's 4,884 meters. And as you mentioned, you covered that elevation by running. Why did you start with that summit and with running?
I knew the challenge was going to be hard, and I didn't want the first day to be debilitating. It's kind of like I wanted it to be, you know, a nice kind of ease into the activity. But then I also kind of wanted to get the running one over with, because I thought that running would be the toughest. And since it is winter and I was running in snow the whole time, it's kind of like going uphill in snow seems to take a bit more out of you. It's a bit slower. It's the slowest going downhill out of all the activity. So I think it was probably the hardest the hardest one. I guess in a way, it was like doing the shortest mountain and the hardest activity kind of canceled themselves out in my mind. And it just seemed like a nice place to start.
Next was Denali, which you climbed via backcountry skiing. I'm sure that the climbing got harder throughout your session, which the total duration was about 10 and a half hours. But did the descending also get harder? Did you start making more mistakes as the day went on?
Yeah, so it was actually it was pretty funny because we got about 10 or 15 centimeters of snow the night before. And so I was pretty stoked to ski powder all morning. But I did it over at a local ski hill. And so I got there just after 5:30 a.m. or something, and I skied, and they open at 9. And right at 9, the lift started running, and you know, all the droves of people started showing up. And the nice powder that I was skiing down and, you know, skiing so easily and having fun turned into these big, heavy, wet moguls. And it actually started kind of like lightly raining as well. And so it went from being like, oh, this is a great idea to ski powder, to all of a sudden, in like within one lap, it was like, oh, this is actually a terrible idea. Because then my legs were starting to go like, when you're skiing heavy snow, your legs get super kind of jacked up and they start burning. But also you want to get down the hill fast so you can like kind of get it over with. So I was kind of towing this line between not overtaxing my legs, but also getting down the hill and trying not to fall or anything like that. So yeah, the downhill actually became probably the harder part. I mean, the downhill is always fun no matter what, but it's definitely started adding up.
That almost doesn't seem fair. Like the downhill's the payoff, and to have it tax you in that way. Yeah, that's just not fair.
Yeah, definitely. It was okay. I can definitely work on my skiing, and skiing hard is like a good way to work on that, but maybe not on the day when you ski up and down for 10 hours.
Next was Argentina's Aconcagua. This was your shortest day at a little less than 7 hours, and I'm looking at total duration that from the Strava posting. To me, this one sounds like the most horrible, and I've told others about this. Granted, they're cyclists who I've told, so the idea of a treadmill already is gross, but to be on a treadmill for that long is like gross with an extra bucket of slime thrown on. So tell me about your setup there. How did you ascend this virtual mountain on a treadmill?
I actually have a treadmill that goes up to 40% grade, so it goes super steep. And it has a little thing on it where it counts your vertical gain, which is also super handy for this. I mostly had it around 30%, 30 to 32% grade. And I just kind of set it there and just zeroed in on a pace I could maintain. And I just went for it. I feel like I watched some YouTube videos. I might have watched a movie. Honestly, the whole day just kind of blurred all into one one big activity, one big kind of mental fog. It was actually a really nice day outside. It was like a sunny day, so being inside on the treadmill was like kind of the worst case scenario. But also, it just made sense for like what I was doing that day and the amount of time I was going to be doing it for. And Aconcagua is the second highest summit of the seven summits. So this was kind of like get some of the vert out of the way. And it kind of evened itself out in the fact that like it was really boring, but it was like an efficient use of time because I was able to do it in like, yeah, just under 7 hours, which any other activity at that effort level would have probably taken a bit longer.
You mentioned pacing. Can you tell me maybe a bit more about pacing and how you sort of thought about it throughout the 7 days? And I imagine it depended on the activity and the effort, and I guess even the conditions outside.
I just basically tried to keep my heart rate right around like 110 to 120 range. And that seemed like a really nice range and that's when I was like going uphill. So when I was like coasting downhill, obviously it was lower, but that kind of heart rate was like, it was just a nice effort because I think it's like you're mostly fat burning zone. You're not really that out of breath, but I was still like going at a decent clip. So it kind of evened itself out, and it was such a case of like pacing a marathon, if you know what I mean. It was like really just pick that pace that you can maintain for an entire week for 7 to 10 or 12 hours a day. because that was the kicker. And it was like just being as efficient as possible. And if I tried to go any faster on after about day three, if I tried to like go any faster than that kind of heart rate range, I would like almost instantly bonk. It was like my glycogen levels were just so low from like day three to seven that as soon as I put in like a bit more of an effort, if my heart rate went up to like 135 on a climb, then it would be just like, yeah, instantly like feeling bonky and feeling low energy and tired and stuff. So I was, it was very important to keep that effort level low.
How are you fueling throughout these efforts? And then maybe also in the evenings or before these efforts, like what was your calorie or your food intake like?
Yeah. So basically for food, I was trying to put like a drink mix in my bottles most of the time, just something that had some kind of calories in it. Or sometimes I would just pour maple syrup into my water bottles and mix that with water, which is like a nice way to get some extra calories in. And then my wife, Lindsay, had baked like just a ton of cookies. So I was eating a lot of cookies, all different kinds, peanut butter cookies, ginger cookies, chocolate chip cookies. And I think I ate probably about 40 or 50 cookies over this week. Other than that, it was just like a mix of kind of like typical training stuff, I guess, like some PB&J sandwiches. I didn't use too much like actual sports nutrition product just because like that stuff is like, if you're going at that low intensity, you don't really need all the fancy ingredients that they use in those more expensive sports nutrition like gummies and stuff. So there's actually a giant tub of gummies you can buy at convenience stores in Quebec called Zone Bonbon, like Candy Zone. And it's like $10 for 2 kilograms of these delicious candies. And so I would kind of fill a Ziploc bag of those. And as much as it was a hard kind of event, you know, physically, it was like almost as much as a eating event. I think I checked my training peaks and I had burned almost 12,000 calories during activities during the week. And then add on like another, you know, 2,000 a day for just other stuff. And actually, now that I'm saying that, that seems low. But yeah, that's just what my training peaks said. But yeah, I would drink probably about a gallon of water per day. And when I got home at night, it was kind of funny. I would just eat whatever I could find in the fridge. I'd usually be so hungry that I wouldn't really wait for my wife to eat because I was just like, get the food in me and then go to bed. So it was like, I was a pretty unexciting husband for a week because I was just, I would just eat and then go to bed, wake up at like 4:30 a.m., eat, get out, and just, you know, start going up and down hills.
Was the recovery enough, like the amount of sleep you could get, even like as you got deeper into this challenge? Or did you find yourself, having a harder time recovering?
I'd say a little bit of both. After about 3 or 4 days, it's like my body kind of reached a homeostasis and I kind of got into the groove of it. Never once did I really feel like getting up was like really early or really hard. I was like really excited every day to get out there and kind of go for it and kind of really sink my teeth into it. But yeah, the recovery, like the first day I finished and I think I put on the Normatex on my legs and I like did some rolling, a little bit of stretching, but that kind of went out the window on day three because it was just like, I would get home and then I would have to like prepare my gear and I would have to eat and I would have to drink and then I would have to, you know, have to shower. And by that, all that stuff takes, you know, quite a while, a couple hours. And then it would be, you know, 7:30 or 8 p.m. and I'd just go to bed. Yeah, there's actually a curfew in Quebec. There still is, but there was during that time as well. So you're only allowed to be outside between the hours of 5 a.m. and 8 p.m. So I couldn't leave my house until 5 a.m. every day, and I would have to finish before 8 p.m. So it kind of gave me this bookend window, and it also gave me like motivation to start earlier. So most of the days I was getting started sometimes between like 5:30 and 6:30 a.m. because by the time you leave, drive for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes to some new hill somewhere and get going, it all takes time. And I think that was another big lesson, like all the little things that you have to do really add up when you only have so much energy and so much time during the day.
Your fourth summit, Russia's Elbrus, was on a fat bike. What was it like to finally, in my mind, I'm like, finally, he's gotten on a bike. Like, now we're cooking. But you mentioned it did, it provided you some relief by switching it up after running and skiing. The fat bike sounds very, though, sloggy, sluggish. Was it a slower day for you?
Yeah, the fat bike was, it was actually faster than I had thought it would be, but it was still, I don't know, fairly slow. I did it on a road with about 270 meter of gain per lap. Elbrus is 5,642 meters. So I don't know how many laps that was, but it was quite a few. Yeah, the fat bike was, I mean, anyone who's ever ridden a fat bike knows they're not the speed demons in the bike world. But it was also the road that I did it on was, it was a gravel road. The one picture I posted shows the top where they had actually kind of scraped the road clear, but the majority of the road was actually snow covered, and it was fairly like chunky snow. So I was pretty happy to have the fat bike actually, because it was like a good tool for the job that day. I wasn't, you know, falling on the descents, or I wasn't slipping and sliding too much. I was getting good traction, and I wasn't sinking that much into the relatively soft snow. I would not have been able to do that day on any other type of bike on that road. So it was kind of cool to use the fat bike and actually like need the fat bike and not just like do fat bike on like pavement or something just for the novelty of it all. So that was something I wanted to do. So I was like, if I'm going to do a different activity, I want it to actually like, I want to need that activity. I don't want to just do it for the sake of it.
I asked Tim Johnson about your Seven Summits challenge. I spoke with the former cyclocrosser and pro roadie because he lives in your area, and he joined you for at least parts of these challenges, maybe not a full one each day, but for many parts of them. And he was struck by the way that each day you could spend 7 or 8 or 9 hours doing an activity. Your Everest climb was, I think, a little more than 12 hours in total duration. You rode with Tim this past summer in Quebec's far north. And the idea that Tim put in my head was that your experience with expeditions, like 7 days of gravel riding along the Trans-Taiga Road or 10 days of fat bike riding along James Bay in winter, those types of expeditions have prepared you for these long efforts to climb virtual summits. Do you think they did? Do you think that sort of analysis holds true, that your expeditions have helped you with this virtual challenge?
Yeah, I think so. I think for sure. I think anytime that you go out and do something that's pretty long and pretty fairly monotonous, you kind of have to come up with mechanisms to keep yourself entertained or motivated. And I'm sure everyone listening has kind of gone through this to some degree or another, but I mean, it could be as easy as like counting pedal strokes, or one thing I like to do is like kind of like hunt for round numbers, I guess. On your cycling computer, you're like, oh, I can't wait for that to hit, you know, 1,000 meters, or I can't wait to hit 2,000 calories, or I can't wait to hit 100 kilometers today, or something like that. And then you have these little mini goals, and I guess there's like a ton of different techniques and even like mental strength, if you can even call it that, learned from going on expeditions or going on even just like day-to-day long training sessions that kind of prepare you for something like this. And this challenge was definitely taking that concept to the extreme, because it was like, it was extremely repetitive, I guess, in hindsight. Like thinking back to it, I'm like, man, I just went up and down the same hill every day over and over. But like while I was doing it, I was like, I was really enjoying it, because like you start off in the morning and you start going, and then it's like, oh, the sun's gonna come up soon. You watch the sunrise, and then you're like, oh, like maybe someone's gonna come join me for an hour or two. And then like, yeah, maybe Tim would show up and ride with me for a couple hours, get to chat with them. And then you're like, oh, well, now I'm gonna listen to some music or listen to a podcast for an hour. And then you're like, oh, now it's noon. That's kind of cool. Like the days, and then you're like, oh, I'm halfway done for the day. So yeah, there's all these like little intermediary goals and things you can kind of work towards as you slowly tick off the laps, I guess. But yeah, in the moment, didn't seem monotonous to me, and it was just fun. And I think the other thing that's really cool is spending all day outside, like moving, you get to see so much. Like you get to see people, if you're on the road, you get to see the people who are driving on the road. Maybe like you get to see someone leave and they go down the road and they're gone for a couple hours. And I'm like, I wonder where they went. Did they go to the grocery store? Did they go to work? Cause then they come back and then they wave at you or whatever. And so there's just like so many little things that happen in the world outside of like our immediate lives. And I guess like spending 10 hours on the same hill, you get to see like all these people and all these like changes in the day and in this track of the sun and in the wind and the weather and all those things. You get to see how it changes. And I think that was kind of like one of the coolest parts of the challenge for me, was like getting to kind of take that all in real time every day.
I find that really cool. It like offers you this ability to do this like deep study on your surroundings and really take it in. And you know, these are all things that you would miss when, you know, if you're doing your normal day-to-day stuff, or but yeah, you actually got to really study the locations that you did these challenges in.
Yeah, I guess you get really intimate with each of the hills. And I mean, I could just go and stick a lawn chair out on the hill and sit there, but then I think all the people driving by would probably think I'm pretty creepy. So, you know, the next best alternative is to ride up and down them on your bike all day.
Yeah, that's right. That's an amazing cover.
Exactly.
Kilimanjaro was your fifth summit. You did that indoors on the trainer. How was that? Like, because when you're on Zwift, you have this instant distraction or this constant distraction. It actually helps you to spend longer on the trainer. But is there a limit to what Zwift can do to distract you and keep you entertained when you're on it for that long?
Yeah, I think I think Zwift has like definitely limited a limited entertainment value, especially when you're going up and down like the same hill, and especially when you're not racing people. Like I think I was riding around 230 watts or so, like basically all day, and it was pretty casual. And like, yeah, like part of the fun of Zwift is like someone passes you and you pass them back, or you're racing someone, or you're like going after a virtual segment or something like that. But like, this was just literally like punching the clock. It's like, all right, let's spend another hour doing this same intensity, same heart rate, eating the same things. So yeah, it was a little less entertaining in that fact, but it was kind of actually in a way nice to be inside, because my face was getting kind of like windburned, and my nose and my lips were getting pretty dry, because most of the days had been pretty cold. Like the day that I did the fat biking, it was minus 24 when I started. And so like just being outside in that kind of weather like all day kind of starts to add up. So like I actually kind of reveled in like the indoorness of being on Zwift for a little while. Like as awesome as it is to be outside, and I love being outside and training outside, it was like it kind of gave my skin a bit of a break from the wind and all that.
You've mentioned that throughout this challenge, you had this enthusiasm that just, you know, you retained throughout the whole seven summits, 7 days. But did you have any low points? I can think of, you know, when you do races or do challenges, you have these, most of us at least have these moments of doubt, or like, I don't know if I can do this. Did any of those kind of thoughts creep in?
Yeah, actually, they definitely did. There are some days when I would like get behind on, I think it was all like related to food and like food and company. Like if I had someone with me and I had something nice to eat, I was like pretty dang happy. And I made sure to check those two boxes as much as possible. Sometimes I would like, for whatever reason, go a little too hard or fall behind on nutrition or something like that. And then all of a sudden I would just like hit these like pretty awful lows, and I would right away stop and like try to eat like two sandwiches and like try to kind of, you know, reset my frame of mind. But yeah, it was kind of like, it was, there were some long days out there. Let's just leave it like that. And sometimes you'd just be low and just like why am I doing this? Why am I out here? And then you'd have to kind of like remind yourself. I didn't have many of those moments, but they definitely popped up a few times.
Everest was your last day. You climbed it on a gravel bike. And this wasn't your first virtual ascent of the world's tallest mountain. As you mentioned, last June, you ran up Everest and you set a record during that event. Which is the better way to Everest? On a bike or by running?
Oh my goodness, biking. biking infinitely.
Are you saying that under duress because you're on a cycling podcast?
No, the downhills on running are just brutal. They really tear you up. Like 8,848 meters of running down a mountain, it really tires your legs out. It's a lot of muscular strain, and like you don't have that on the bike. On the bike, you just flip a U-turn, coast to the bottom, jam on the brakes, and go back up. So it was I said that to Tim when I finished. I was like, man, that was so much easier than Everesting on foot. And some people, when they Everest on foot, they actually do, it's called like assisted descending or something. I don't know. Some people like get someone to drive a bunch of bikes up to the top of the hill, and then they like ride down, get off, and run back up, which to me just seemed like such a logistic nightmare. And like, who would possibly want to do that for me for like 10 hours? Like, that just sounds terrible. So I was like, when I ever stood on foot, I was like, I'm definitely going to run down the mountain. But yeah, running down that much really beats up the legs. And it's like, you'd never have a break. I think that's the other thing. When you're biking, even if you're only coasting down the hill for a minute or two, you have this like break, this mental break, this physical break, like your heart rate drops. When you're running down, it's like you're basically going the same intensity the whole time, because like I was running down at probably like a 4 minute kilometer pace down the mountain and then turning around and running back up the mountain. So it was like my heart rate was basically the same the entire time. So yeah, a lot of factors kind of would add up to make, I think, making cycling the clear choice if you're going to if you're going to Everest.
How did you feel when it was all over?
When it was all over, I was pretty excited to like sleep in actually the next day. I think that was like my biggest excitement. I was also like pretty proud of like pulling it off. I think that there was a lot of logistical and like nitty gritty things. And I like realized I could have definitely like given myself an overuse injury crashed at some point on one of the descents. I could have, like, there's like so many things that could have gone wrong. I think I was like moving for 55 hours or something that week. It'd be pretty easy to mess it up in one way. And that didn't happen. No mechanicals, no injuries, no kind of anything. And I actually ended up having like quite a bit of fun the whole time. And I think for me, it was like the right amount of challenge. It was like, there was times when I didn't know if I would finish or didn't know if I should finish or could finish, would finish, you know? So definitely, I think I chose the right level of difficulty, because I got to the finish line and safely, but it was, there were some touch and go moments out there.
I imagine some people listening to you speak about this challenge will be inspired to try it. You know, also based on 2020 seeming to be the year of the Everest challenge, maybe 2021 will be the Seven Summits challenge, who knows? But not many people have the ability to set aside 7 days or access to similar terrain. But what advice might you have for your average cyclist, let's say, who wants to try this challenge but yet needs to scale it in some way that makes it more manageable for this rider?
Yeah, well, first of all, I must say that I'm pretty excited to do this again in the summer, the summer edition. And I think that'll kind of bring in a whole new perspective to it. And so, yeah, anyone looking to try it like this summer, I guess it'd be pretty similar. First of all, I think I would recommend switching it up a little bit. Either if you wanted to do it all on a bike, at least switching up the bike, maybe doing a day on a mountain bike, a day on a gravel bike, a road bike, maybe not a fat bike in summer, but you know what I mean. And then even doing, if you can change activities, it helps a lot. The other thing is steep hills. I was always trying to find something that was steep, because it like as much as going up a steep hill sucks, it also, I think it sucks more to have to like do an extra 50 kilometers of distance during the day. So I think for cycling, you want to choose something between 10 and 15% grade. And I think for if you're doing it on foot or skis, you want that number to be quite a bit higher, somewhere around 25 to 30% grade. And that way you just, it just goes by faster. You can kind of just accumulate the meters quicker. Another tip would be food, like plan your food out well. And I would always stash my food kind of at the bottom of the hill. So after every 20 or 30 minutes, and I would come by for another lap, I would be able to grab the food and then eat it as I kind of move up for the first couple minutes of that lap, which was really nice. And then, I guess choosing your clothing wisely. Anyone who wants to try the Seven Summits, which I totally recommend. It was just such a cool experience. You'd obviously want to train for it. And so if you're training for it, you're going to get a pretty good idea of what clothing works for you. But it's kind of unique because, especially in winter, because it's cold out. So clothing that would work for a long bike ride doesn't necessarily work as well for Everstein or for like just doing big days of vert, because you're getting hot on the ups and then you're getting cold on the downs. So it's like stuff that's like windproof in the front and then super breathable in the back was like the clear winner basically every day that I did something. And then just unzipping all the time on the ups and then zipping up on the downs was pretty critical. So yeah, using the clothing that you figure out works well in training, and that'll probably err towards the side of stuff that, like I said, breathes well but is warm in the front.
I guess there was no one at the top of these hills giving you sheets of newspaper to shove in your jackets like they do at the Tour.
No newspaper out there. On the fat bike day, it was cold enough that I had to put on a jacket at the top of every lap for, I'd say, 60 or 70% of the ride. So I would just like tie it across my chest, like a sash, so that I wasn't sitting on the jacket. And then just as I got to the top, I would put it on and rip down. Cause yeah, when you're going 50 or 60 kilometers an hour and it's minus 24 out, it's pretty chilly. I don't know what that is with the wind chill, but it's cold.
What is one thing that this challenge taught you? What is a big takeaway for you from this challenge of doing the Seven Summits?
I think I learned a lot of different kind of lessons from doing this challenge. I think that like one of them would have been just how if you keep going, like you can really accomplish a lot. I think the first day I started out and I had calculated that I was going to have to climb around 142,000 feet of vert. And I remember looking at my watch after the first two laps, and I had done basically 1,000 feet of vert. And I was like, oh man, I have to do 142 more of those. Like it seemed so crazy because yeah, I was running and it was slower and it probably took me, half an hour or so to do the first 1,000 feet of going, running up and down. And I was like, oh man, this is going to be, maybe this is too much. But then like you just kind of keep at it and eventually you get there, eventually you get halfway, and eventually you finish it off. And I think that was a pretty good lesson for myself, one that like I feel like I thought I had already learned, but it kind of just like really reinforced it, kind of eating that elephant one bite at a time. I think the other lesson was like taking control of your like reality, because it gave me so much like power and kind of joy to like have this challenge and have this activity to go towards. And I think that like with the pandemic and with restrictions and all that, it was just a bit of a bummer for me, and I'm sure for like basically everybody, to have these things that you want to do that you couldn't do. And so this was like every day when I woke up and I was like, I'm going to do this today and like no one can stop me. And I would do it and then I would finish and then I would go home and eat a bunch. And it was just like, it was just a really great feeling of accomplishment every day. And I think that whatever your challenge is, if it's doing a Seven Summits or doing an Everest or just going for a long ride or whatever it might be, I think having those kind of goals and challenges that you can do and that you can do safely during this time was like the most important thing to me.
You mentioned you're going to try the Seven Summits again in summer, but what are maybe some other challenges you might have lined up this year?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a good question because like I have all these, you know, ideas and challenges, but like I wanted to do them last year too and was, you know, wasn't able to. But I would really like to ride the Colorado Trail this year on a mountain bike. I'd like to set the fastest known time on the Vermont Long Trail, which is like a hiking trail down in Vermont, 273 miles long. Unsupported, that's like a cool challenge I want to do. And then, yeah, I think I'm going to try to fat bike, or sorry, I'm going to try to Everest a few times on bikes this year. Maybe do it again on foot, see if I can kind of set an even faster time, kind of refine that goal. And then, yeah, I think like I'm going to keep coming up with goals, but also try to roll with the punches in terms of restrictions and being told what I can and cannot do. And yeah, hopefully try to keep finding things that I can do instead of the alternative.
Well, Ryan, thank you for taking us through this challenge. It's inspiring. And yeah, your insights are kind of cool. And they speak more to than just, you know, kind of the, let me put it this way. On the surface, this seems like a gonzo kind of stunt, but there's actually more beneath it. And I thank you for revealing the layers to this challenge to me and to listeners. And yeah, keep us posted on what else you got going this year as you roll with those punches, as you say.
Will do, yeah. I'm hopefully this, you know, maybe this gives some people some ideas of what they can do in their backyard.
And that's the episode. It's written and edited by me, Matthew Piaro. I had help from web editors Terry McCall and Lily Hansen-Gillis. The Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast is produced by Adam Killick. He composed the music too. Thanks to Ontario Creates for its support. And thank you for listening. Please rate and review the show. Ride safely, especially if you are doing a multi-day effort like the Seven Summits. And I'll talk to you later.